You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The human brain is a marvel of evolution. No other animal's brain comes close to ours in terms of relative size or complexity when looked at among species both living and extinct. How did our brains evolve? What are its unique capabilities as compared with other animals, specifically our closest evolutionary relatives, the great apes? In a wide-ranging and fun new cultural, historical, and biological nonfiction work called A History of the Human Brain, From the Sea Sponge to CRISPR, author Brett Stetka takes us on an epic journey across the ages, weaving together the history of life on Earth and research on the great apes in helping readers understand how the modern human brain came to be and where it might be headed in the age of genetics. Brett Stetka is an editorial director at Medscape.com. He's a former neuropsychiatric researcher, a non-practicing physician, a freelance health and science journalist, and a regular contributor to NPR as well as Scientific American, where he writes about neuroscience, psychology, and evolution. His work has also appeared in Wired, Men's Journal, Slate, Popular Mechanics, and The Atlantic. This is his first book. Brett Stetka, author of the new book, A History of the Human Brain, From the Sea Sponge to CRISPR, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Well, Brett Stetka, welcome back to Medical Monday. It's good to have you back. Let's start broad and just ask you, what led you to want to take on just the mere history of the human brain?
Sure. Well, I've always been interested in science. My father was a geneticist, and, you know, from a young age, you know, there were science books sitting around the house and microscopes, and I was incredibly interested in it, probably trying to, you know, please him in some way. And so I always knew I'd probably end up in science if I couldn't be a rock star or professional guitar player, or if that's even a job. I don't know if it is. But I got to college, majored in biology and music, and loved science. Went to medical school at UVA in Virginia, and ended up just doing a lot of research in neuroscience labs. I studied Parkinson's and MS, and somehow fell into a research job that led to me being a health and science journalist rather than practicing medicine or working in the lab, and have just been writing about my interests for the last 15 years, which really are the nexus of neuroscience and evolution and anthropology. So when I got asked to write a book, I got approached by an agent who asked if I had any ideas, and I said, I do not have any ideas. I have no idea what I would write about. But I did some research, and no one had really written a layman's book about just the history of the brain and how it evolved. So I pitched that, thinking this is probably too broad, but someone bought it. You know, my publishers are Timber and Workman Press, and they took a chance on it, and it worked out.
I think you hit the sweet spot, because I did not expect you to have, I know you're writing, and I followed you for several years, and I think of you as a medical writer, medical science writer, but you really delve into anthropology here and a lot about evolution, which, you know, certainly falls under science, but really, really quite interesting. And I mean, the history of life on planet Earth, and in a kind of a short volume, which is what's so impressive about it. You do it at a high level that I think really keeps the reader engaged and, manages to tackle a great deal of information.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the kind words. And yeah, anthropology and evolution have kind of been my side interest, or my side hustle, if you will. I've always been interested in that. I've read Darwin and Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins and these guys for, you know, probably since high school, certainly college. So I was up on that, but that's certainly where I had to do more research, because, as you said, I work at Medscape, which is a division of WebMD, where I focus on neurology and psychiatry, and I'm an MD. So I had the medical background, and that's where the research came in, because, you know, I wasn't as how life arises from no life, the organic from the inorganic, and the anthropological trajectory of hominins, or, you know, humans after our split with chimpanzees 7 million years ago. So that was kind of the fun part, really brushing up on the anthropological aspect.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that word was actually new to me, and I don't want it to get gloss over our listeners, but
sure.
Can you differentiate the difference between a hominid, which is a term I think many people are familiar with, and hominin, which was the term I had not heard before?
Yes, so hominid refers to any of the quote-unquote great apes, which is a somewhat arrogant title that scientists gave us and the other smart primates many years ago. So hominid refers to the great apes, so humans, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans. Those are hominids with a D. And then any species after our lineage, but with the chimpanzee lineage 7 million years ago, is generally referred to as a hominin, with an N on the end. So this is Australopithecines, like Lucy, the famous Lucy fossil, named after the Beatles song, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and any member of the genus Homo, so Homo erectus, Homo naledi, Homo sapien, Neanderthals, Denisovans, those are all hominins, which basically just means they're closer to humans than they are to chimpanzees.
Yeah, and it isn't the sort of the caveat that beings who walk on two legs or walk on two legs as a baseline as opposed to the ability to walk on two legs or something like that?
Exactly, yeah, because, you know, chimpanzees and bonobos can walk on two legs and gorillas, but, you know, they're better on four, and if they're, you know, scared or running away from something, they're kind of dragging their knuckles and using their forelimbs. Whereas in Australopithecines, probably around 4 to 5 million years ago, you see us coming out of the trees due to climate change and becoming, you know, really bipedal. And there are a set of famous footprints from Laetoli in Tanzania of an Australopithecine couple probably walking side by side that have been recreated at the Natural History Museum in New York here. So, yeah, that's a defining feature, and probably by about 4 million years ago, we were on 2 feet for sure.
Okay, so let's stick with the apes just for a minute here. And you have quite a bit about the great apes. And, you know, there was actually a story, I think, on NPR this morning about bonobos and about their...
I saw that. Yeah. I was like, I should have written that.
Well, so they're a fascinating species in and of themselves, but we're probably more accustomed or more knowledgeable about chimps. But they're very different in their behavior, and you spend a little bit of time on this. Can you share with us some of those differences?
Sure. The generalization is that chimpanzees can be incredibly violent creatures, and they're the only other species that gangs up to murder other members of their species. That's, you know, part of the dark side of their reputation. And so the generalization is that we share a lot of our violent tendencies and our bad qualities with chimps, whereas bonobos are much more peaceful species, and they are matriarchal. So the joke is that, you know, they're run by women, so there's no war and everything's fine, and that's how we should maybe be running the planet. But they're much friendlier, they're more peaceful, and a lot of this has to do with they have a lot of sex. You know, to be honest, also, you know, they're very sexual species, and you name your relationship or anything you can imagine, they probably do it, and that's why it's difficult to take, you know, your children to the bonobo enclosure at a zoo. But what that does is it quells male tension and male aggressiveness. So it's, you know, males can be really violent, but with frequent sexual activity, it almost defuses the male, like, anger and aggression. So women are in charge, and the community tends to be more peaceful, and just a nicer community in general, and they do not murder each other like chimpanzees do. And Richard Wrangham at Harvard, a famous anthropologist, he speculates that that's just because of where they evolved, their ecology. The bonobos evolved in the Congo River Basin, which is incredibly lush and has plenty of food for everybody, and chimps evolved more eastern in Africa, and there was just a lot more competition, so they had to be violent to survive. And we share 99% of our DNA with both. So somehow we're probably entwined with both of these. We share benevolent qualities with bonobos. We share some of our worst qualities with chimpanzees. And just like us, they can be very nice. They can be, you know, it's a complex world to be a hominid.
It is indeed. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Brett Stetka. He's author of the new book, A History of the Human Brain, From the Sea Sponge to CRISPR, How Our Brain Evolved. And Brett is also a freelance journalist, but also an editorial director at Medscape.com. And this new book really is an incredible history of the human brain through the ages. Brett, I want to ask you, you mentioned the Museum of Natural History in New York, and in your acknowledgments and actually in the body of the book, you talk about Ian Tattersall, and you mentioned that mural, but you got to spend some quality time there. Tell us what that was like, going kind of behind the scenes at the Museum of Natural History.
That was great. So Ian Tattersall runs the Hall of Human Origins at the Natural History Museum in New York. He's a curator emeritus. He's just a great guy. He's an anthropologist who studied lemurs in Madagascar years ago, and now runs this division of the museum. We met under a huge Native American canoe from Alaska that they brought to the museum over 100 years ago, And he took me into this somewhat secret door, and we're in the wings of the Natural History Museum, and it looks just like you would think. It's these ancient cabinets with just fossils and bones, and I think I mentioned in the book he opened a random door, and it was filled with reindeer skeletons. And so then we just sat in his office for 3 or 4 hours, and he walked me through basically our recent evolution, Australopithecines, Homo erectus. He's the one that put together this diorama of the Australopithecines walking together with the footprints that were found in Tanzania and determined that they were bipedal, walking on two legs. And he's got a number of really interesting books out, too, if anyone's interested on our evolution. So, yeah, he was really helpful in just kind of drawing the more recent history and where humans came from in the last 2 to 4 million years. Yeah, and he's been very helpful since then. He's just an all-around interesting thinker when it comes to human evolution. I'd encourage people to look him up, Ian Tattersall, and check out his books.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, I love those kinds of special tours that journalists or authors can get kind of behind the scenes, and you picture, I don't know, Night at the Museum or something, but even better.
Oh, it was totally that, because then at the end we were in his office, which is, you know, an ancient relic of an office. It was amazing. And then he opens this door, and all of a sudden you're on the main floor of the museum with tourists all over the place. It was like they were right there the whole time, and I had no idea. So it definitely felt like a night at the museum.
Wow. I want to ask you about a concept that I think many listeners will be familiar with, and that is that we often think humans are special because we have large brains, and it's really more that our brains have so much capability and they have evolved, as you know, thoroughly articulate in the book. But I don't know if it's the scientific or anthropological or both, but it's the concept of encephalization quotient, and that's the more formal way to think about it. Can you take us through that, you know, how that is considered and where we fall on the scale?
Sure. I think people myself included, before I started researching this, tend to think of, you know, the bigger the brain, the smarter the species. And, you know, it's not really an accurate way to measure it. You know, a blue whale is incredibly intelligent, or an elephant, these big-brained animals, but they're not quite as intelligent as a chimpanzee, say. So Dr. Jarrison, back in the 60s or 70s, developed this idea of an encephalization quotient, which is the size of a species' brain compared to how big you would predict it would be for a species of that size. So, a chimpanzee and, say, a large German shepherd are about the same size and weight, but the chimpanzee's brain much larger than you would expect for a species of that size. So a chimp has a EQ of about 2.5, whereas humans have one of the highest, or if not the highest, at about 7. So our brain is much, much bigger than would be expected for a, 150 to 200 pounds animal. So that's the encephalization quotient. And I think the other key point with evolution is that it's not as if, you know, there's a goal. It's not like species are evolving to become more intelligent and continue to strive to be more intelligent. It's just, as you know, John, it's just it's the adaptability of surviving in your environment and reproducing and passing along your genes. So for us, that meant a bigger brain or a more complex brain, because we were on the African plains where we weren't the fastest, we weren't the strongest. You know, we had no chance against a lion until, you know, we invent guns 500 years ago. So it's acted on being intelligent for us. That's why we quote-unquote won out. But as I write, bacteria, there's trillions of bacteria, so if you're talking pure numbers, they're doing just as well as we are, if not better.
Yeah. Well, and along those lines, in terms of our evolution, you write in a couple of spots in the book about something called the obstetric dilemma, which I guess I knew about from medical school days and things, but I had never really, I guess, read about it so clearly or articulately. Share with us what the obstetrical dilemma is.
Yeah, that was an interesting concept, too, that I vaguely recollected, but definitely researched a lot in writing this. So as selection is acting on us to have these more complex brains and bigger brains so we can survive on the African savanna, someone has to give birth to that big brain, right? So it's the moment we become bipedal, and walking on two legs, that's easier to do with a narrower pelvis. So, in order for women to have a baby with a big brain, you have to have the baby earlier in its development. And so this is the obstetric dilemma. So they set we're born earlier on, our brains are softer and more malleable. We have, these fontanelles, these areas where the skull isn't fused when we're born. And that's the reason that we are so helpless for you know, who knows, 20 years. I mean, certainly until adolescence, you know, we do need our parents or our community to survive, which is a good thing because then you have all that time to take in environmental influences, which shape your brain and to the sharing of information and you know, what defines us as being human and creative beings. But it also means, like, you need your parents for many, many years, where most species, certainly mammals, come out and are ready to go in a matter of days.
Yeah, one of the interesting evolutionary tracks you focus on were the marsupial species, which you don't talk a lot about that, but evolutionarily, they kind of didn't, I guess, thrive as much as mammals, with placental mammals like we are. And yep. What are some of the positive reasons for that?
So I researched this and I talked to a couple of biologists about why that is, and the overall idea is just that we had there were just many more mammal species. I mean, marsupials and monotremes, another group of mammals, you know, they're odd. They're kind of outliers. There weren't that many of them, whereas there were, you know, I think there were under 100 species of marsupials, and there were 4,000 or 5,000 species of mammals, still are. So we just had more rolls of the dice. We had more chances to evolve big, complex brains just because there were more of us. And it, you know, it really only happened in a couple of lineages. It happened in the primate lineage, which led to us, and then it happened in the smart sea mammal lineage, you know, with orcas and the intelligent porpoises. But, you know, for the most part, it was really just 2 out of 1,000s of mammal lineage that did develop complex intelligence.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is author Brett Stetka, who has just written a new book called A History of the Human Brain, From the Sea Sponge to CRISPR, How Our Brain Evolved. And in a short space, it is a comprehensive history of really of human evolution and the evolution of our brain. One of the really fascinating parts of the book that I really did not anticipate either was sort of a history of how nutrition has really played a seminal role in our brain's evolution. You know, you basically, I don't know if you're making the point or you're talking about various researchers that have, but seafood turned out to, is thought to, I should say, have a huge role in developing the enormous brains that human beings have. Can you sort of take us through the thinking on this? Because that was really interesting.
For sure. So I think one of the key drivers of our evolution, and the reason why we survived the way we did, is how omnivorous we were and still are. I mean, we eat, you know, we eat just about everything compared to most species. We can survive on grasses, fruits, vegetables, fish, meat. And this really saved us at many periods of population decline in Africa. You know, if the fruits in the forest dried, we could, you know, dig up tubers and rhizomes in the savanna and vice versa. And there's a theory by Curtis Marion, an anthropologist in University of Arizona, that humans nearly went extinct about 150,000 years ago, or at least this one population did. And they saved themselves by learning how to track tides and shuck oysters, literally. Like, they found fossilized piles of shells from oysters and mussels and sea snails. Seafood really, you know, there's a theory that the nutrients in seafood are incredibly healthy for our brain because the brain evolved at sea hundreds of millions of years ago, the animal brain. But a lot of people think it was just sheer calories, and that by that point our brain was already big, it was complex, and if you were coastal, shellfish may have saved some of our population groups. If you were inland, maybe it was more hunting or more collecting fruit, but you know, seafood is still incredibly healthy for the brain when you talk about omega-3 fatty acids and iodine and all these marine nutrients. So I tend to think it was a little bit of both. They were incredibly healthy nutrients for the brain, and they were just calories, reliable calories. When you can track a tide and, you know, collect some oysters, you're going to survive.
Yeah, and so there's a historical anthropological argument here for meat, and that the fact that flesh, I mean, and it started here with seafood, but one of the anthropologists that you interviewed, I think, talked about the fact that, hey, we want to be enlightened and be plant-based for the role of nutrition, but let's, you know, we can't whitewash history here, and let's say that admit that we probably got to this point by surviving on eating meat. Can you say more about that?
Yes, I think that was Barbara King from William & Mary in Virginia. And she's mostly a vegetarian, but she acknowledges, as most anthropologists do, that once we started reliably accessing meat about 2 million years ago, first through scavenging what, you know, the lions left behind, and then later hunting, our brains balloon. They literally double in size over, you know, thousands of years, but pretty quickly on an evolutionary time scale. And so some people think that, again, it was the nutrients in meat and the iron and the vitamins that provided, you know, the nutrition to allow our brains to evolve, whereas overwhelmingly, anthropologists at least think that it was actually just such a reliable source of calories that all of a sudden you didn't have to scavenge all day. And certainly once we had fire, you could preserve that gazelle meat. You have food for days, if not weeks, and now your hands and your time are freed up for other pursuits. So you can go out there and work on your tool making or your weapon making, and selection can then act on those other skills because you're not worried about collecting food all day. So meat really was a turning point in our big brains and in the human saga.
Yeah, and then you go on from there to talk about agriculture. And so, you know, agriculture, I think, often is presented as a great human societal benefit. And, you know, you force, I think, the reader to rethink that a little bit in terms of some of the cultural mores that are implied from agriculture, where it sort of forces, for example, gender roles, and it makes us much more intense about property ownership and things like that. So that was a really interesting part of the book, too. Share with us a little bit about that evolution, if you can.
Sure, yeah. There's a writer, Christopher Ryan, who great science writer, who wrote a book about this. And, you know, he and others, agriculture was basically the downfall of human civilization, or just we didn't have civilizations yet, but just humanity in general. Because it did really, it was the first time, this was probably about 11,000 years ago, when in 8 different regions around the world, agriculture popped up independently. And it really was the first time that humans had a concept of ownership. I own this land. And then, of course, they needed people to work that land. So then you get this class hierarchy forming and this, you know, fiefdoms. And really the birth of class-based civilization, where people are in different social strata. And, the owners of the farm are, you know, end up with the power. So it really, you know, it led to the civilization that we know today and the global economy that we have today, but it definitely had its downsides, and then it class stratified society. It certainly led to slavery and, you know, owning, quote unquote, owning other people. It brought with it a lot of, it kind of brought out human, our darkest side, our selfishness, our tendency to want to own property, to own a product, to own a crop. It was a mixed bag. Unfortunately, you know, you couldn't stop it once we started farming, because it did provide enough food for the community. So it did, you know, had its positive aspects. But yeah, I think it also brought out the worst of us in a certain sense.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what I like about the book. It makes you think, you know, it makes you think in different directions.
I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. Sticking with that theme of nutrition and how it has impacted our neuronal and our brain development, you have another theorist, I think this one was Michael Crawford from Imperial College mm-hmm. London, and his hypothesis, I guess, is that mental illness is really a reflection of the abundance of food, and this was kind of new to me too, but can you clarify some of that?
I can. So he's the leading proponent of this idea that marine nutrients are so healthy for our brain because the animal brain evolved at sea. And he was really one of the first researchers to identify omega-3s as being so healthy for the brain in the 1970s. You know, he's partially responsible for why you go to CVS and you can buy your omega-3 supplement. And so, he's shown that if you source omega-3s from fish in the rat, they're incorporated into a rat brain 10 times more efficiently than if you source omega-3s from land or from plants or animals that eat omega-3s from seeds and flax and things like that. So he really thinks that it's the decline in marine nutrients globally that is contributing to our, you know, the increase we've seen in depression and anxiety and even psychoses and schizophrenia. He thinks that's because despite, you know, local food movements in wealthier countries, certainly the U.S. and things like that, globally our diet is still becoming increasingly, you know, just produced. You know, it's overproduced food, and that a lot of that is because we're not eating seafood. We're not eating nearly as much seafood because people just don't have access to it, and it's easier to eat processed meats and processed carbs. So, you know, there's something to that, I think, because there's been about, I think, four randomized controlled trials linking the Mediterranean diet with improved risk of depression and anxiety. And, you know, I think there is something there, and that's something, you know, globally we're going to have to figure out going forward, because how do we feed 8 billion people in a healthy way?
Right, and considering that many of our fisheries haven't been really deemed so sustainable because we've overfished, you know, many specific populations.
Yeah,
I was, you know, slightly disconcerting, I guess, but the hypothesis, at least, you know, on its face is certainly interesting and one to consider. I wonder if you would also share with us the concept, and we've talked about it on this program before, but your vision of pruning, that is this idea that we have this great explosion of neuronal development where our neurons, you know, double or triple, like I think in utero and then in infancy. And then there has to be this kind of shaping of our brain, of our neuronal connections. And how does that work to the best of our understanding in terms of both evolution and the science?
So during brain development, you're exactly right. The brain is forming, you know, literally trillions of connections. So your neurons connect to each other via extensions called axons at connections called synapses, and you film trillions of these. And it's basically a trial and error setup. So it's like, let's throw all these connections together, and then the ones that you end up using are maintained. And most of them, as you grow through childhood and through the teenage years, literally wither away. Those tips of the axons and the synapses, they die off. And so it's basically, you don't want too much brain activity. If you have too much going on, you can't make sense of anything. And they discovered a couple years ago that there's a gene associated with schizophrenia that results in a lack of pruning. So you end up with way too many neuronal connections, which can explain the disordered nature of schizophrenia, the disordered thinking and the scattered thoughts. So it's a fine balance of, you want to start with these trillions of neuronal connections, but you want to scale it back to make sure you don't have too much going on in the brain. Otherwise, it's too much for us to process.
The name of the book is A History of the Human Brain, From the Sea Sponge to CRISPR, How Our Brain Evolves, and it is pretty much a comprehensive tour de force in under 250 pages, and it is by my guest today, Brett Stetka. Brett, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on the book.
I really appreciate it. This was fun. I'm really glad I could be on, and happy to do it again. And yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, we'll definitely keep our eyes open for the next project. Brett Stetka is an editorial director at Medscape.com. His new book is A History of the Human Brain, From the Sea Sponge to CRISPR. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening. Please stay safe out there and get those vaccines as quickly as you can.